You are listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer. My guest for episode 256 is Bruce Sword, best known as the singer and guitarist for the British neo-prog group Pineapple Thief. You're right now listening to Private Paradise, the opening track to the first Pineapple Thief album, Abducting the Unicorn, in 1999, later retitled Abducted at Birth. As we'll discuss, he was in a band called Vulgar Unicorn before this point. Pineapple Thief started as a solo project, but quickly became a full band. There have now been 16 studio albums under that name, plus 4 solo albums by Bruce. We'll be discussing Pillars from his latest solo album, Ghost in the Park, and the title track to It Leads to This, the last released album by the Pineapple Thief, 2024. And looking back to Clapham from the Pineapple Thief album 10 Stories Down from 2005, and ending with Alone at Sea from the Pineapple Thief 2014 album Magnolia. For more information, see brucesword.com and pineapplethief.com. For more about this podcast, see nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. To support the effort, go to patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. I will play a little bit of Private Paradise by Pineapple Thief from Abducted at Birth, 1999. The album was originally called Abducting the Unicorn. I know in our communications before this, I had said I was going to use an actual Vulgar Unicorn track, 1995, House at Fudge Corner, but I sort of chickened out after listening to those three albums. Is there a reason that those three are not republished? Is it just a matter of who owns the rights and that kind of stuff? Or is it actually like, no, this is how you want to represent yourself sort of as birthing?
The Vulgar Unicorn days, we were a bunch of kids basically learning. This was the days when you used to go into recording studios. It cost kids a lot of money back in those days, you know, 16-track local recording studios. And we'd go in for a day and try and record and mix 3 songs, and it sounds like it. That's the thing. So those albums, you know, I'm proud of them. They're part of the process. Mm-hmm. But no, there's no reason that we shouldn't put them back out. I'd love to remix them, but they're all on tape somewhere in the country, maybe buried in landfill somewhere. But, you know, one day I'd like to do those Vulgar Unicorn albums justice. But yeah, certainly for me, it began in 1999 with Abducting. That was when it really started.
A number of things are labeled a remix. So it seems like you care about your, you're curating your older stuff. I don't know, are advances in AI such that, oh, now I can take these 4-track things or whatever and actually soup them up in ridiculous ways that were not like, is that an exciting prospect in terms of returning to some of these old things?
Yeah, it's something quite recent that, you know, they call it stem splitting or, you know, whatever, but it's come a long, long way, even in the last couple of years, to the point now where anybody can go out there and strip the drums out, strip the vocals out. It doesn't sound as good as if you've got the tapes, sure, if you can really split it out yourself. But yeah, actually, maybe we could go back to the stereo files and just, when I listen back to them, you're thinking, my goodness, this really is, you know, kids. We were like 17,
sure,
you know, and these studios, they were pretty cheap studios, but they were still expensive for us.
All right. So 16 or so Pineapple Tree albums later, plus some live albums, 4 solo albums, plus a one you did with Jonas Rensky in 2013. We're going to play something from the new solo album, the song Pillars from new album's called Ghost in the Park. Can you catch us up where you're at now? Why this solo album now?
The solo and the Pineapple Thief kind of exist side by side. The solo thing, I have to admit, is very, very personal. I've made a decision that is 100%. I'm just going to put it all out there. So Ghost in the Park was an album about life and death. My parents were, you know, my father was dying. My mother had Alzheimer's. So I was singing about it, but in a positive way. I don't want people to think, oh my God, he's written an album about his mum, dad dying and things like that. It was just sharing, really, you know, things that all humans have to go through. This song, Pillars, is part of that canon of songs about life, and this one particularly just looks back on childhood and parents bringing up children with the fear of God in them, that kind of thing. It's actually about an old ascetic called Saint Simeon who stood on a pillar for 37 years because he thought that was some kind of penance. So I just thought it was quite a funny story to sing about.
Thank you. Would you have her to sit on a pillar for 37 years, perhaps 38? What would you have her do just to earn your life? And oh, this house is not knows what they say to stem the bleeding. Oh, Lord, only knows. Lord, only knows. So what did you have it do? Kneel down on her hands with an iron chain.
It's a very mellow sort of tune. Where is this main electric guitar sound that sounds like every note is a harmonic? how are you getting
well,
that?
Well, this is something that I've always kind of got attracted to ever since I started messing around with open tunings. And I messed around with open tunings really because when I'm playing chords and I think, oh, do you know what? I really wish I could play that sound, but it's the wrong sound. So do you know what? I'm just going to tune the string. So I have these really crazy open tunings. And what that allows you to do is you can play the harmonics and these become chords. So this particular track, that's that. I think it's in a D minor.
Okay, so it's not just clever use of pedals. You're just actually playing harmonics. All right.
No, it's actually true harmonics. It makes it a little bit of a pain when you have to play live because you've got to have all these different tunings and that's a trade-off. So yeah, it's something that I love doing and it opens up all kinds of creative possibilities. So as you start changing the tuning, everything that you've ever learned, every shape of guitar chord that you've ever learned just goes out the window, which is quite nice, actually.
I mean, are you trying to play things from this album live? And in what, live solo, live with a band, or?
Well, funnily enough, I'm talking to you right now in Sofia, in Bulgaria, because in about 2 hours' time, you've got a solo gig.
Okay.
So me and John are here, John from the Pineapple Thief. Yeah, we're doing a lot of songs. So I've got about three acoustic guitars, one tuned in open D minor, one tuned in North standard. There's a couple of little minor tunings that I do in the middle of the set. So we can do it, and we are doing it.
Okay, so just bass is handling the whole, you can sustain on your little harmonics while he does, you know, the dun, tick, dun, 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 that he's filling whatever is happening.
He is, yeah. And we got loop pedals as well. So we create loops. And so it's more than just the two of us. There's a lot that can go wrong. It's quite a lot to concentrate on. But when it works really nicely.
Does this include like a drum machine that you're using?
So John's got this little electronic drum thing. It's called thing that he actually plays live loops. Mm-hmm. So everything is live.
Sure.
That's what I love about it. It's all live. And there's a lot of jeopardy. So you start a loop, John does this loop on his thing, and the red light basically comes on, and it's like, you've got to get it right. You've got one chance to get it right, because if it goes wrong, you've got this loop going off into the distance, and that's wrong. So it's a lot of fun. I like it. It's very, very different to playing with a Pineapple Thief.
So one of the things you're doing to thicken your voice throughout is having these little high octave vocals come in and out. So I assume that's just you singing against yourself, not an octave or pedal or something.
I tell you what, the thing about John, he learned how to sing as a kid, as a choir boy.
Mm.
So he can sing really high in a really sweet voice. So I sing at this normal voice and John comes up in this octave. And people say, oh, Maurice, it's just you and John, when you sing together, it sounds so wonderful. And I'm just saying what people tell me, but I think the reason is because me and John have known each other for 35 years. Mm-hmm. So we played together when we were 18. So I think there is definitely a connection with us on stage.
Well, so on the recording, though, is that, do you still just do that yourself, or are you having...
No, John does it.
Oh, okay. All right. Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay.
On my solo record, I do it. On The Pineapple Thief, John does it. Yeah.
That was the question. All right. Yes. So this is you on the solo record. Interesting phrasing on this song, just to earn your... No, just this sort of very deliberate. I mean, was this a bunch of poems in a notebook kind of thing, or are you writing with guitar in hand? What's the term of these articulations?
So it's interesting you notice that. I think as I've grown as a songwriter, you learn about the things that can really make your ears prick up. And things like throwing the rhythm of the vocal is something I think is really interesting. So if you're like doing this repetitive thing, which a lot of people do in the verses, you know, you get a rhythm going. But then if you all of a sudden you throw it off the beat or change it, it just brings that interest in. And so over the years, I've just learned to do that. It's really with picking up the guitar and singing at the same time. You know, you just do it. And I think, you know, how many years I've been songwriting and it's still learning every single day, it's one of those things you pick up, just like you said, just for people like you to notice, I think. And I think, you know, it's still rhythmic, it's still something, and it creates a hook.
Sure.
And also if you're singing it live, you can really emphasize that dun, 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 you know, those kind of things. It becomes a hook. So it's all part of the songwriting craft, I guess, that I'm still, like I said, I'm still learning.
Well, and even though you've got this deliberate delivery, it's just earn your love. You know, it's not your love. You know, this because there's room to fancy it up. Obviously, that doesn't fit the tone of this song, but it seems like you have done less in more recent years. Like your earlier albums, there's a little more pushing and straining on the vocal, and you know, trying to be more quote unquote singer, lead singer, as opposed to just deliver in a nice, pretty way.
I think what I've learned from the beginning is that when I really try and sing loud, it doesn't suit my voice. And that's something that you always try and do, especially when in the early days when you're on stage, you're always fighting the sound.
Sure.
Before in-ear monitors, you're kind of belting it out. And I think as I've got older, I've realized that actually singing softly is a really nice thing. And it suits my voice, to be honest. The truth is, when I start to really belt it out, I kind of you kind of get this whiny register. Doesn't sound nice. Well, I didn't think it was.
That's the other reason I wanted to play some of Private Paradise rather than the other thing. Actually, I wasn't sure. The vocals on the first Unicorn album, are those even you?
No.
Okay, no, those are not.
So just taking about the whole Unicorn, I was kind of just a guitarist. I did help with mm-hmm. writing some of the songs, but the real genius in Vogue Unicorn, he was a genius. If he had not given up, he would be doing great stuff. Was my old friend Neil Randall. He was a driving force. And the reason I did Pineapple Thief at the very beginning was that he never wanted to play live, and he got bored. You know, he went off and tried to do films and things like that. So yeah, I wasn't singing. We had various different singers. Neil sang. I sang a couple of songs on, but yeah.
Sure.
The House on Fudge Corner track that you were listening to, yeah, that's someone else.
And then the first Pineapple Thief album, when you're pushing, I was thinking Smashing Pumpkins. Like it has that Billy Corgan.
I didn't want to put Billy Corgan into your head. But the truth is, at that time, at the beginning of Pineapple Thief, I was a big Smashing Pumpkins fan, and I absolutely loved Adore, the Smashing Pumpkins album Adore, ironically, which isn't a particular favourite of Smashing Pumpkins fans. So I did this thing where I just basically sang like Billy Corgan, and it took me a while to develop my own style. I think the thing was is that I was a guitarist who wanted to write songs and then has to sing. That was how it started at the beginning. I think that happens with a lot of people. People like me, you sit in the bedroom, you play guitar, then all of a sudden you think, oh, I want to write songs. So you start writing songs and you think, do you know what? I'm going to have to sing now. And you're never really a singer. You don't ever think of your voice as an instrument. And that's something for me that came later.
Well, if you were purely just delivering the lyrics in the nice way, then we wouldn't, to stem the bleeding, whoa, we wouldn't have as many whoa-ohs and ahs and things. So clearly, yeah. you're still using your voice as an instrument. Yeah, any thought about when you're going to put in an oh-oh, you know, how this works with the text?
Yeah, true. So it's normally ahs generally ahs. I'm not sure if I've done an e, but yeah, okay, oh. I'll put that, and I'll make a note of that.
Well, we're going to do, it leads to this next. We have an oohs in that.
Yes,
and,
we do.
We have, but to say on this for a little more. Yeah, so I wasn't totally clear. Obviously, the tone is clear, and you're telling, is this about an abuser? If you want to talk about what the song's actually about. Like, I wasn't really clear. So,
I think if I was honest about where this came from, and I don't want anybody for any minute to think that this is an anti-religion song, because it is not anti-religion. But in my experience and what I've witnessed with, especially in my early years, of parents, mothers and fathers who are supposed to love their children, but seem to be more concerned about the wrath of God, and everything is defined by that, about the reckoning, about the rapture, all that kind of stuff. But it really impacts on these poor little children. And I was one of those. I was one of those who was like, you know, you're terrified as a 6, 7, 8 year old. You're absolutely, you are forced to have this fear of God in you. And you're thinking, oh my goodness, what's going to happen to me? Well, you know, I go to church every Sunday, which was quite an old church. And I would spend the nights having nightmares. And there's this one particular person this song is about. And I think that actually everything you did was not for your children. It was because you were worried about your own salvation. So it was that kind of thing. I had nothing against religion. I think religion is great. I think it can lead people in the really righteous way that they don't think about themselves. Actually, the best way to think of religion is actually you are thinking about other people. But a lot of people don't. That's where that song really goes. You know, this house is not in order, basically.
Well, the fact that you're using Lord Only Knows, Oh Lord Only Knows, it certainly doesn't sound like, you know, XTC's Dear God. It is not that kind of song. Interesting, you know, to settle the score with God, which sounds like, you know, I'm going to settle the score. You know, it sounds like you were, as opposed to the score is infinitely all nil. That is,
yes.
God has all the, so there's no possible way to settle that score, at least without getting into theology here.
Yeah, and that is unfortunately our lot, that there is no way. And especially if you believe in this kind of original sin and all that kind of stuff. So we are born so imperfect that we are never, ever going to be anywhere any near. But all we can do is try. Yeah, it's a deep thing. I don't want to alienate anyone at all, because that's why I keep coming back to I am not anti-religion at all in any shape or form, but I am certainly anti some things I see in religion.
Well, let me play actually that line around to settle the score with God, because I just thought this big electric guitar you introduce in that verse, which then does an interesting thing, to, you know, that makes that line more scary. I don't know.
To settle the score with God.
Although actually, when you get to God, we're again, it's nice again.
Yes.
And then that guitar nearly disappears, even though, you know, it's got to push the energy up a little bit for the chorus. But that thing sort of settles down because we have the introduction of the harmonic guitar again. Yeah. Any thought about how you're weaving and blending the various guitars on this?
Well, it's funny you should pick that up, because I deliberately mixed that guitar in the verse very loud. And I think I was kind of influenced, really, by Nigel Godrich for that. If you listen, there's a particular Radiohead song. Not that I'm a big Radiohead fan. You know, I like them, but, you know, I'm not a massive Radiohead fan. I'm a big Nigel Godrich fan, the way he mixes records. And he mixed the guitar so loud that you're thinking, my goodness, how could you do that? But I've never noticed it before. But it works. So I kind of nicked that. I kind of brought the guitar almost into your face, even though the verse is there. It's almost like sharing the lead with this verse. And I think you're right. That kind of gives it that edgy kind of, like, you're kind of thinking, oh my goodness, this is almost on the edge of, and it does this kind of discordant I guess, again, it's kind of a bit Smashing Pumpkins influence, the way that, that Billy Corgan used to play his guitar. All that kind of comes through from my formative years as when I was young. And as a mixing engineer, it's about the balance. How long can you get away with that kind of on the edge? And then when the chorus comes in, it's about bringing it back, but not bringing it back so that you go, oh, where's it gone? You bring it back as if you're kind of releasing yourself into the final chorus. It's not easy. I'm not sure. I know. Never sure if I get it right.
Well, let's talk about how you wrap the song up. So we have the, in fact, let me play at 2:45. No. Yeah, any thought about that choice of we're going to swoop down, we're just going to kind of sit on the same... Obviously, that could have gone on for another 2 minutes if you wanted to sit there and the ohm, you know, just let the...
I kind of felt that I wanted to do this kind of resignation, that you felt resigned to your fate. You're kind of resigned to this is how it is. I'm now going to be able to tell you that you are so wrong because what do I know? What I do know is that what's happening has had a negative impact on people. This kind of melancholy end. And what I kind of liked about it is that it left it hanging. It kind of feels unresolved, which I like. So in a way, I'm kind of thinking, you know what, that's not resolved. And then you kind of think, let's play that again, hopefully. Let's play that, have another listen. But yeah, you're right. It could have gone on longer. I don't know. You know, I grew up with progressive rock, but I also like grew up with grunge and all that kind of stuff. So I've always had a push and pull between that 3-4 minute song length and thinking, what the heck, let's just do whatever and go 8, 10, 12, 15, 28 minutes, I think, is my longest.
The space rock thing, even more than progressive, you have to like structure it. But if it's space rock, then you just keep, you know,
just carry on noodling. Yeah. Yeah, noodle away until you can't be bothered anymore.
That also reminded me of one more mixing thing. Right from the beginning, it seems like you have a crash cymbal that is so reverbed that it just takes up the world, and it's right there at the end. It's sort of,
yeah, it's got this thing on it. I don't know what they call it because I'm not a drummer, but the thing that you drape over the cymbal so it resonates for ages.
Okay. Again, it's a real effect. It's not an electronic.
Yeah, but a cymbal, is this cymbal ever going to stop? No. And I think you can grab it and it will stop.
Yeah, well, that provides a nice parallel or, you know, a thickening thing to that, your harmonic guitar. Let's get the second song out there, right? We've talked about you're in a solo environment, and so you can focus just on what you want. You're not making room for other people. To The Pineapple Thief, the last album, it leads to this. 2024. I guess you had an EP right after that. Was that sort of leftover songs from that album, or was that a
same session? Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So the same session. So the last proper full album. Say a little about where you were at with this band at this point before we hear the song.
The lineup for a start was locked in. So it's me, John. I've already spoken about John and Steve Kitch. I've known Steve since goodness 1996. So we were three very good friends. But then we were without a drummer, but we were lucky enough to get Gavin Harrison in 2016. So we'd been touring with Gavin. The band was tight. We'd done so many shows. We shared a tour bus for goodness knows how long. And so we kind of felt like the band was together. We trusted each other. So I think with at least this record, it was a real case of a true collaborative effort. I mean, I still come up with a lot of the melodies, the words, the meanings of the songs, but everybody else did their bit. I mean, to sum it up, it is greater than the sum of its parts. It really is. And obviously, someone like Gavin in the band, you've got an incredible basis. You know, everything starts with the drums. And if the drums are as good as what Gav does, then you're onto a winner already. So that's how we felt. And I just wanted to make the most of it.
What you see is no surprise, but it's not the half of it. Always there by your side, in the cold black center of your eye. You made your mark, a life of toil, but that's irrelevant. The traces worn away, by the long march of your decay. So it leads to this. How could we get it so wrong? For all this time, for all this progress. For all this time, for all this progress. For all this time, for all this progress.
So I actually purposely picked a song off this album that did not sound like it was entirely drums first. As we were talking before we got on here, we had sort of half an interview, an aborted interview, one of the only times this ever happened to me just for technical reasons, back in 2018. So you were sort of pretty fresh. Gavin had just joined the band recently, and I've really been thinking about this in terms of, you know, what would I do if somebody, one of the world's greatest musicians of whatever that wants to join your band, but then you want to make use of the person. You don't want to just, you know, do your solo album and say, okay, fill in some space. I'm sure he would do that, right? He's an adaptable player. I just talked to Richard Barbieri, who's had Gavin send him tracks. But okay, this is the band that Gavin is going to be playing live in, and you want to make it a truly collaborative thing. So it just seems like a very different way of constructing songs. It's a compromise, right? That you get the awesomeness of having that in there and having really amazing standout drums in every single song, but you have to make room for that. So it sort of did that increase the need for solo albums? Like, okay, this one is not, you know, this is too to the point. This is not quite a Pineapple Thief song anymore.
You're probably right. I mean, you know, I thoroughly enjoy hearing what Gavin comes up with, but you're right. In terms of the drums, the way that Gavin arranges his drums is very, very different to your standard rock. I mean, there's plenty of progressive rock drummers that are doing imaginative things, but I think Gavin is kind of unique. Like we said before, you just want to use it. Just use this unique thing that Gavin does and the way that he approaches composing it. That's what I say. He doesn't just play drums. He composes his drums. And that's not to say that Gavin just says, here we are, I'm going to do this. There is still a debate. Sure. You know, we still have this debate. But, you know, sometimes you think, you know, actually a lot of drummers, all they do is play a backbeat through this. You know, Dave Grohl would just go all the way through and, you know, and you would, and it would still sound all right. And it was, but you're not going to get that with Gavin. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. You don't get that. You get a composition, a drum part that flows, that grows. And that's not to say that Gavin doesn't lock down and play a backbeat. He does a lot. And when he does, it's brilliant and you can really look into it. But to get there, there's normally a process. There's normally a journey where he's really crafting what he does on the drums. And we sort of are happy to sort of play with that. We ever made a decision to say, do you know what, Gav, can you just play like Dave Grohl? Just do a backbeat. Kind of, you know, well, one, he'd probably quit. And two, it wouldn't be right. It just wouldn't work. So it is what it is. That is the Pineapple Thief sound now that we've had for 10 years.
Well, and you were telling me about that first album or second album that you had done with him that, you know, I know he just has a great drum setup at his house. He knows how to do the mix. He just sends you stereo tracks, or at least, you know, that was the case with Richard. It seems like you guys were ready. And on that album that you were all doing, it seems like your own tracks from home and combining them. I think that's what you described at the time. Yeah. Seems like you guys were ready for the pandemic.
Yes.
Before it happened, that you were already creating album. So with this album, are you in a room together, bouncing ideas off each other? Again, how are you working with the band at this point?
Well, funnily enough, this was the first record where we did that.
Okay.
I spent a lot of time at Gavin's house, which is quite strange because Gavin will sit down with me and he'll say, hey, Bruce, I've got this idea. And he'll look at me and say, right, what have you got? What have you got? Can you come up with something to this? And I'm like, you know, okay, put me on the spot. You're just not used to that kind of thing when you're so used to just being sent stuff in your little studio where you can sit down and all the time in the world and work something out. When you're in his room, it's like, oh my goodness, I've really got to come up with something. This is old school. This is like being in an old 70s studio where you've got 6 weeks to come up with a record and we all sat around jamming. And it brings something really special out. And so we came up with lots of songs like that. Rubicon is one. I mean, there'll be some news soon, but obviously the next album, which we've done, we've taken it even further where the whole band is together. We've gone to a studio. It has evolved. So we did the pandemic thing, where we were all in our separate rooms. Do you know the one thing, the reason why we all got together in the room, and we want to do it more and more, is it during the pandemic, we all got together and did this live stream thing. Then we realized, you know what? It sounds better when we're all together and we're all playing warts and all, just playing live, as opposed to just doing it this clinical way where everybody's just sending stuff in and you can spend ages making it all so perfect. I think that's what we kind of moved away from in a way, certainly the last sort of 4 years.
I mean, I'm interested how Steve fits in with that, because some of his key riffs in here are this, like, it sounds like something that was a sound that was created to be an effect, like a producer sort of thing, right? Isn't that he started as your producer in the band and he replaced the keyboardist? That's what I thought I read that somewhere.
No, well, he's always been a mastering engineer. So he's always mastered my stuff. And yeah, then he kind of appeared on the keyboards. And I think where you probably got this from is that Steve is really, really good at telling you whether something's any good or not.
Okay.
He's got this kind of thing where he can't lie and he can't even sugarcoat it. So it's like, you get it. In fact, what he's learned to do is kind of put it in the sandwich, call it a shit sandwich. So he says something nice, then he tells you, actually, Bruce, this is the worst thing I've ever heard. But, you know, I think you've got a much better one in you. You know, it's definitely got potential. So he'll tell you, and then I'll go away and go, oh, okay, Steve just told me that song's no good or that idea is no good. And then you go away and come back. So, yeah, Steve's always the first filter that I put my ideas through.
Well, much like Richard Barbieri, who was telling me, like, oh, I don't really play keyboard. You know, I'm not Rick Wakeman or something. It sounds, at least if you had told me that you did these keyboards, like, because you were just so into the technology rather than, you know, a keyboard, I wouldn't have been surprised. But knowing that this is Steve's thing, these sounds sound too created to be jammed. So how does he work in terms of we're all just jamming together in the room?
He likes playing the Rhodes and the piano.
Okay.
And he's a fairly decent piano player. With those songs, he's there at the beginning. He's actually, it's almost like me strumming a guitar. He's sure. playing the piano with Rhodes. What he's really good at, and very similar to Richard actually, is that he's kind of a bit of a sound designer. He's got a Prophet, that his favorite keyboard is his Prophet 5, or it's, I think it's Prophet 6.
Beep, one he was. Beep. In this song, what do you know? Is that the Prophet?
Yeah. All those soundscapes where you're twiddling knobs and it's all evolving and there's filter sweeps coming over, all that kind of stuff. So he kind of almost like sprinkles his fairy dust on the tracks at the end quite often.
Yeah.
I'd imagine Richard is kind of a bit similar with the way he works with Porcupine Tree. He kind of, it's all very sort of his the sounds. And same with Japan. When I was listening to Richard's stuff with his work on Japan, it's a similar kind of thing. It's this ethereal kind of sounds and that you can just takes you away.
The fact that this is built on this little funky guitar riff, I mean, was that the foundation of the song or was it a drum thing that you then added that...
I had in my head that I wanted to have a track that was hooky and that would be fun to play live. That's exactly what I was thinking when I picked up this guitar and said, right, let's come up with a riff, you know, a riff that is like, that's hooky. And that just came out. And then the other song just evolved from that riff.
All right, let me play from 105. I guess I was trying to figure out how you were making it grow from section to section here. I'm even interested how this becomes a live thing with a single guitar. Are you using looping pedals?
No. So interesting. So listen to those two sections. I remember when we were writing this. So you've got it kind of lifts. And this is a case of Gavin playing a backbeat, actually. So he's playing as just groovy backbeat. And then you're thinking, well, it wants to rise even further. So then it goes up another notch. And then these other guitars come in, guitars. But actually, that was really down to Baron Matthews, who's our live guitarist.
Hmm.
So we got the second guitarist that came in and did these really great guitar parts. So that's the story of how that one evolved.
Okay, so that when that initial distorted guitar, that's you.
Yeah.
And then he's coming in with the higher part that is stretching over it. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, so he's doing the sort of the ba-da-ba-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-
blues that we heard, we had, I think, parallel octaves above and below.
Yes.
So is that John doing both of those?
No, actually, Baron. So we had John and Baron and probably me.
Okay.
So live, we've got three-part harmonies, which is big enough, actually. When you're in a big room, that's enough. But I think with the studio, we kind of reinforce it a little bit. I think what we've done, I mean, we kind of look back on it, leads to this, and said, yeah, it's not as layered as our previous records, but it's still layered. It's still layered so much that you probably can't play it live like it is in studio. So what we've done with the newer stuff that we're doing now is that we're doing it so that you really only get the parts on the record that are going to be played live. I do concede that with this record, there are more layers than physically we could play. In hindsight, I'm kind of a little bit of a regret that we did that. It's okay for the recording, for the studio, but because we're a live band, just as important, the live and the studio, we kind of should be more mindful of that, I think.
Let me play from around 1:30, this interlude. This is going to go on for a while, and it has, the end of the song has the same thing. But yes, what sort of 80s, I'm trying to think what if I've heard this exact,
yeah.
And it really lets you really build the tension, and the synth is stretching upward a little bit, and you can kind of, yeah, any thought about this as a structural thing?
I'm sure that riff has probably been done. That's the thing about when you do these simple riffs, you know, bum. But what I loved about the end of the record is that it kind of always got, and this particular track, I always had it one ear on the live show, just thinking, you know, with the lights and the atmosphere, it was just going to work. It was going to be perfect. And then at the end, there's this guitar solo with quite strange effects on it. What I've done in recent years is re-found my love for guitar and solos. There's not that many on, at least, to this. There's quite a few sort of whammy bar effecty solos. But the stuff we've been doing recently, there's a lot more guitar solos. I kind of realized that actually guitar solos are okay. It's all right to do a guitar solo if it's nicely crafted.
Well, I didn't know sort of as a prog pan, right? If you add Gavin, who's taking up so much space down there. I mean, either you want to just leave space for that. So it's like the Police.
Yeah.
Right. where you get your Stuart Copeland is taking up a full third of the space, and that's great, or more. Well, especially that part I just played, you and John are exactly right. Are in unison. It sounds like
You're
just playing that riff together, but it also, you know, calls out, okay, well, if you got drums that are that big, shouldn't you also have the Steve Howe or the Rick Wakeman, something else to stretch it out in some direction?
I mean, that's the thing. And you could do that, and then you would just have a very, very massive sounding record. And that's not necessarily something that we want to do. We want to keep it so that you can hear, kind of like you say, everything has its space. Obviously, the vocals are obviously critical. But yeah, I still kind of feel that we can make it big without having to layer in these everybody like fighting to have their massive sound coming out.
Well, and I wasn't sure if your approach to soloing was because, you know, kind of like I was describing these keyboardists, that they're not the flashy soloists, that they're more just, they know how to use their sounds. That clearly you are very, very good with your pedals. I can play one note and have it sustain in a great way and have it do interesting things without having to do a bunch of hammer-ons or something like that. But is that, well, that's the sort of the limits of your fingers, or is that just your taste such that these older things, right, the Vulgar Unicorn stuff, some of the earlier Pineapple Thief stuff, there's more active guitar work. Was that because you had a lead guitarist playing with you, or was that just, no, you let yourself be less tasteful at that point?
Yeah. I mean, no, it was all me.
Okay.
I think a bit of both. So technically, I'm very lazy when it comes to guitar playing. I have a guitar because I want to write songs.
Sure.
So I'm not the kind of guy that will sit down for 4 hours going shredding up and down a fretboard until I can do it. I wish I could, you know. I wish I could shred. I can't. I can play fine. My heroes really were people like Andy Latimer and Ian Benson, you know, Alan Parsons Project guitar solos. They're technically still good, and they occasionally do these fast licks, but generally they're about the hooks, the melody. You know, you can sing along to their guitar solos. So that's always been my motto. You can sing, you can feel something from it. Like I said, you haven't heard it yet, but the stuff that's coming next, I kind of found my love for guitar has come back. So you were talking about the early years where I was like, you know, maybe being less tasteful.
Sure.
Which I understand, that's fine. I think for the new stuff, yeah, I think I've gone back there. Yeah, less tasteful guitars.
Well, speaking of very tasteful, very song, you know, nothing particularly progressive about it. I had picked from your early work, Clap 'em, originally from 10 Stories Down, 2005. The version we'll play is the remix for the 2008 3000 Days album. This is just the one that I had picked when we were supposed to talk 8 years ago or whatever that was. And I still love the song, and it has, you say you're not a Radiohead fan, it sure has some good Radiohead vibes, or at least that period of Somewhere Only We Know, that kind of English pop.
That, yeah.
Any thoughts about this before we play that?
Yeah, it's very English, that's for sure. I mean, I wrote it at Clapham Junction, which is a big train station in London. And the reason it's called Clapham is because I stood on a train as we were coming into Clapham, and my father rang me and he dropped me the news. I mean, this is another sort of sad story, but he dropped me the news my best friend had died suddenly. He just had a heart attack in his sleep and died. We were only in our mid-20s. So it was a big shock. So I went back and I wasn't going to write a song about my friends. You know, that was just too much. It was too big a thing for me to just go to write a song about that. But I wrote a song about the feelings and what it felt like for me to be stood on this platform in Clapham Junction, looking out and looking at everybody and thinking, oh my God, my best friend is not here anymore. You know, one of my best friends, it was me and John, actually, me, John, and we call him the two Johns, and now there's only one John. And so I wrote a song, and it's dedicated to people really who feel lost and like there's no hope, but actually to try and convince them that there is hope, that that there is a lot of reason to live and a lot of love. And the sentiment is incredibly simple, incredibly done a million times. But I think that's why people write so many songs about it, because you're trying to make sense of it, trying to make sense of stuff and to share, really. So that's where it came from. Yeah, because of course it's got the old Mellotron flutes.
Yes, yes.
At the beginning. So, you know, that makes it prog. It's got the Mellotron
Well, and I feel like this beat, like it's not actually a Latin beat, I don't think, a specific Latin beat, but it has because it's got the rim shot and it's just a very...
And it's got the offbeat, yeah.
Yes. Do you even know what kind of beat that is in particular?
No. Or, okay. You know, the one thing, and this is the thing that makes everyone else in the band laugh their heads off, is that I'm completely illiterate when it comes to music. You know, I can't read music. I remember this guitarist I knew, he would always like say, I'm doing this guitar in the style of blah, blah, and in this kind of blah-de-blah scale, and in the style of some guitarist from wherever. And I'm going, does mean anything to me? Means nothing to me. And so this is the way I write. And the way I've developed as a musician is that I've just literally just done it by ear. I've got terrible technique as a guitarist, but I've just learned myself. And that's it. I'm too old now to relearn my golf swing. I can't do it.
Well, yeah, if I want to say, this is like, is that a bossa nova that I have to think of? Dun, 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 dun. Like, I have to think of a specific song. I don't know.
I think
forms.
If there was a bossa nova button, is a bossa nova button on your little keyboard that you had as a kid, that's definitely it. Yep.
All right. Having it a little bit danceable, but to provide a platform for a depressing sentiment, right? Because, you know, if you really are, I'm thinking of some of these like Peter Hamill sort of solo things where there's no discernible rhythm necessarily, and it's just purely expressive. And, you know, okay, that's very prog, but it's a little harder to go down here, that this is actually, you know, a very pretty song and one that somebody who's never heard any prog or whatever, like, would be very fine with.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's the whole Western thing of, because we're talking about backbeats. Mm-hmm. It is effectively a backbeat, but with that kind of slightly bossa nova-y feel. So, and I think it's just because as Westerners, that's what most people need. You need that pulse to hook in. And so, yeah, I was always comfortable with having that pulse going through the record, that particular song.
Let's just play the beginning of the chorus here. I know it's been a long time, but you did remix this in terms of, like, that's the key moment where I call it the beauty drop.
Right.
We're going to have all the nice things come in. We're going to have some nice piano here. We're going to have the drums come in. But just getting the proper move in dynamics to go into that part. Any thought about constructing that? And, you know, this was still, you'd done quite a few albums before this. So this is only early in a relative sense.
It was early. And I think that's, as a songwriter, that's what you always trying to get. And I guess as a song structure, this is a typical Western sort of pop song. You have an intro, a verse, a chorus, a verse, a chorus, and end. And that's what this song does. But in order to make it work, in order to connect to people, you've got to get that kind of what you just described. You go into that chorus, you've got to lift, everything's got to hit exactly right because there's so many people doing this kind of thing. So for it to be special, you've got to really get everything right. And I don't know what right is, to be honest. I don't think there's any kind of real method behind it. But when it works, you know straight away. And I always call it the magic. It's just this magic that happens, and you can't really describe how or why. And I remember strumming it, and I just went into those chords, and I came up with that vocal melody and think, you know, that is it. You know, Steve came and did that really lovely arpeggiated piano. Just one of those moments where a song just happens.
So still you and Steve and John, and who was playing drums on this, do you recall?
Oh, Keith Harrison. Yeah.
No relation.
So he played on a couple of records. He played on 10 Stories Down and All the Wars. So, and he was our live drummer for a while. So, yeah, that was back in the day.
And it seems like you weren't necessarily thinking as much about, as you're saying now, like, oh, we're a live band. You're doing whatever you need to do for the studio version to work. So if we need to introduce three more acoustic guitars to boost that pretty part, we're going to do that. Or am I wrong here?
No, it was 100% studio. Yeah, we did the odd show. This was in the days where you would get these little prog festivals that would say, hey, Bruce, can you come and play this prog festival in France or wherever it is? So we got out maybe three or four times a year to play. But yeah, I'd say it was really a studio project. And probably was until we probably did Magnolia. It was very much more geared towards the studio.
And when you have strings come in... Do you recall? I mean, it sounds like maybe you have a single viola or something like that. Whether you had, are these actual strings or is this more Mellotron, fake Mellotron magic?
No, actually, I have very fond memories of that. This is my school friend, a guy called Richard Hunt. And he was the reason, one of the big reasons why I picked up guitar. He was a great piano player and a really good violinist when he was 14. And I was really jealous. I said, oh, you know, I want to play something. And I went and bought a guitar. And I said, it was too late for me. There's no point in me starting. I'm 14. I'm old. And he said, it's never too late, Bruce. It's never too late. And so I always remember him telling me that. And then sort of, when was this? Must have been 15 years later. I called him up and said, do you mind coming over and playing some violin? So he just overdubbed. It was just the violin, no viola, all violins.
Okay.
And just did three or four overdubs. So it's all real.
And let me play near the end.
Now, is everywhere to go?
It sounded like the cymbals actually match your finger picking. Yeah, any thought about, do you remember how you decided on this ending as opposed to something
else? Well, no, I think it just came. I remember Keith was really, really good at playing with his cymbals. He was kind of a jazz player by training. The way he would get this really subtle but lovely sounds out of his cymbals. So, yeah, I just remember him doing that. It's just one of those moments where you're kind of working, you're playing with each other. So Keith would do these things, and it probably impacts on how you play the guitar. Funny enough, it kind of ends in a very similar way to Pillars. You know, it kind of comes down into this sort of unresolved ending.
Just returning to the narrative a little bit, you're here with nowhere left to go, you're facing this alone. So this was sort of an imagined to him before or in the afterlife or sorry, I've lost track of how you said this.
No, so I think the song really is about loneliness. I was kind of full of sadness, you know, hearing, and the song was called Clapham because of that. It wasn't about my friend.
Sure, okay.
So the song's not about my friend.
Yes.
It was so, but it was about people, and we've all been there, and people, lots of people come up to me about this track in particular and say how much it helped them and brought them hope, and because they felt hopeless and lonely, and did anybody understand what it feels like? So just writing these simple words, that's really what it was for, just to try and remind people and myself that life is good and it's tough, but it's also good and this world is amazing. So that's my general philosophy in life, is that life and the world in this planet is beautiful, but it can be tough.
Yeah, so a general utility sorrow treatment song, you know, whatever your thing that
is. And like I said, it's nothing groundbreaking. It's a very, very basic, simple sentiment that's been sung about a million times, but I don't think we could ever get tired of trying to deconstruct it and sing about it.
That ending that we just played, the lyric there, it's everywhere to go. It's everywhere to go. Yeah, what is that? Because that sounds like you've got your whole life ahead of you.
But it's
ending in that, in as you said, with the same tone that Pillars did, which is sort of the such is the way of the world, or, you know.
Yeah, I kind of just imagine someone in their melancholy sat on top of a hill looking out over the world, kind of feeling just, I guess this sums up melancholy. And that's that. And that you still wanted to say you got everywhere, everything to do, but it's still melancholy. It's not, you're obviously not going to go, don't worry, everything's fine, everything's great. Because, you know,
I mean, it could twist to a major chord. There could be a little something nice.
I mean,
the tone has been very nice, like a warm blanket over you the whole time. So we don't necessarily need. And you have the beauty drop again. We've had our major chords.
Yeah.
So it's not necessary to end with that, I guess.
Yes. I think so. I just don't think, not sure how many major chords I've got in me.
Well, to say goodbye here, I had picked last time, probably my favorite tune from you, Magnolia, definitely a high point for me in terms of the pre-Gavin conception of the band, being your whatever neo Radiohead pop music. So Alone at Sea is the one I had picked off of that. Any thoughts about that era and the overall arc of your career here?
Yeah, I'm really proud of that song. We still play it live, actually, mm-hmm. Alone at Sea. And funny, I just want to say that we got this show in Sofia tonight, and I start on my own, and I play Clapham, funnily enough.
Ah.
So, so it's just quite apt. But yeah, I remember Alone at Sea. Again, it's very, very similar sentiment to Clapham. It's about, actually, it's a love song. So it's about spending the rest of your life with someone. And it basically you and me alone at sea, because it's me and you together, almost saying to my wife, well, you know what, you've signed up with me. It's there's this sort of metaphorical suicide that you're doing, you're taking by being with me forever, you know, that you are committing yourself to me and me to you. So it's kind of a dark love song, but I remember it's in seven, you know, I love seven as a time signature, and it has this riff at the end which goes to four, which I really love. So I love it when you get out of the seven and you lock down and go into the 4-4. I mean, it's always a brilliant moment in life. So it covers a lot of ground, this track. I think from a songwriting perspective, it's one of the songs I'm most proud of.
And who is the drummer on this one, do you recall?
Dan Osborne, yeah.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, Dan, great drummer. He kind of saved us, because when we were doing Magnolia, we didn't have a drummer. He came along, knocked our heads together, told us to carry on, got us playing together again. So I have him to thank. But after Magnolia, he just wasn't able to commit to the band. So it's all, we still see him. We're still very good friends. But yeah, he couldn't commit. So it's a one album only, Dan Osborne, Magnolia.
All right. Well, before we hear that, let me just ask, you already mentioned, right, the Pineapple Thief has its new album. What is the stage of it? Is it recorded? Is it?
Yeah, it's all done. It's all done. There'll be some news on that. Yeah, watch this space. There'll be plenty of news coming about. I think the next sort of 18 months for the Pineapple Thief is going to be very busy.
Was there a new direction with that in particular?
Yeah. Yes, it does sound quite different. But like, I mean, probably the most I can say is, like, I was talking to you about layers and mm-hmm. and making it true to the live show. I think it's pretty much. We've gone there, you know, we all did it together in the studio. We played together and wrote it together. It's going to be interesting.
All right. Well, thanks so much for chatting. It's really been a pleasure revisiting, updating myself on your catalog. Glad we could finally make a whole interview happen.
Yeah. We got there in the end. Yeah. No, I've enjoyed it. It's lovely talking about the songs in depth. So yeah, been good.
All right. Here it is. Alone at Sea from Magnolia.
Time.
Thanks so much to Bruce. That was a tremendously satisfying interview, mainly because, as was mentioned, I prepped up a whole interview, tried to talk to Bruce back in 2018. I had technical issues. The call kept cutting off. We did end up recording for over 30 minutes, but then listening back, the sound quality on my end was garbage. I had a driver's issue that was causing both the bad sound quality and the cutting off. For whatever reason, we couldn't reconnect to just do the interview over or finish it at the time. But I've kept an eye on these folks as the Pineapple Thief has come out with more albums and was very glad to get this opportunity to finally talk to Bruce. You can learn more about his work at brucesword.com and pineapplethief.com. Now, Pineapple Thief is known as a neo-prog band, but as you've heard on this episode, the line between contemporary nice adult pop music and prog is thinner than you might think. When I play Van der Graaf Generator to my wife, she wants nothing to do with that or its prog ilk. But Bruce's music is so tuneful, so tasteful. There are definitely songs that are way more metal that I did not show you on this podcast. And if you're familiar with Gavin Harrison's other band, Porcupine Tree, which the Pineapple Thief is often mistaken for, you'll hear a lot more metal influence in that band. I will link in the blog post to this at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com or patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. I will link to videos for some of these songs, live tracks, the albums from Vulgar Unicorn that we mentioned at the beginning. If you do support me via Patreon, you can actually hear that previous partial interview with Bruce, and you can also see notes for both of the episodes that include the lyrics and the structures, all that stuff. Again, that's patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. I've continued to have a jam-packed summer despite a somewhat slower release schedule here. Since talking to Bruce, I talked to Josh Joplin and most recently to Dan Montgomery, two really excellent songwriters. So please come back for those interviews. I welcome your feedback on the show, your suggestions for guests you are putting forward yourself as a potential guest. That's mark@nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. I'd also love for you to go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to this and give the show a nice 5-star rating. Maybe send this episode, some other episode you like, to a friend. Post it on your social media. Artists like Bruce and shows like this deserve more circulation than they get, so I encourage you to do your part. Thanks so much for listening. Hope you're having a good summer. Keep on musicking. Till next time, this is Mark Linsenmeyer signing off.